The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're off and running on another week of broadcasting here at beautiful Edstone. Speaking of beauty, my wife and I were enjoying a little bit of the weekend away for our anniversary down at the Cotswolds, only 30 miles or so from Edstone, but boy, it sure is beautiful. I know sometimes when we travel around the UK, we appreciate just how much God's blessed us with the Edstone campus, because it's hard to beat. But the Cotswolds is, of course, there's nothing like God's campus, but the Cotswolds is close. So if you get a chance to visit Edstone, maybe you can take a Sunday afternoon excursion to one of the beautiful cities in the region, just about 30 miles south of us here. Well, a few updates on the work. We've got the Glasgow pack coming up in the middle of March. I think some have gotten that confused with the online pack, which is now less than 2 weeks away, February the 24th. The regular pack, where we're on location, that's scheduled for March the 16th and 17th. We've got 15 people. We just sent out the first invitations on Monday, a week ago. So we've gotten 15 so far that have registered. Hopefully we'll have many more by the time we get to the middle of March. Also, just to update you on TV production here in the UK, the programs that we produce here, of course, they play on television, national television here in the UK. And then we post them later as Trumpet Daily videos. But over the last couple of weeks, we've had a couple of shows that we didn't post on the website as yet, because we're still trying to sort out some issues with the background and just technical components. I think we've about got it ironed out. But 2 weeks ago, we had the Church of God's Finest Hour, where we went through some of the material that we covered in early January, right at that 40-year anniversary of the state of California's attack on the Worldwide Church of God. And then following that, last weekend, or I guess it played over this past weekend, we had a program titled Esprit de Corps, I think, sixth chapter of the Overcomer booklet, where it talks about the example of Napoleon and how that he really did inspire his troops to sacrifice for their country, for the empire, even to the point of sacrificing their own lives. And so we offered that Overcomer booklet, which we've offered several times before. We didn't get a huge response for it, I think 76 in total. But then this next week, the one we taped just at the end of last week, it'll be playing this weekend, a pivotal sign that we're living in the last days, and we'll be advertising the new booklet that goes by a title very similar to what we put there for the program. And that booklet we just received a few weeks ago here at Edstone, so we'll be excited to advertise that for the first time on television here in the UK, and then hopefully that program will be posted on the Trumpet.com website later this weekend. Well, on today's radio show, we're going to be coming up in the second segment. I'm going to be going through a few stories that they really are disturbing when you look at what's happening to our nations internally, what's happening with our families, what's happening with the economy, what's happening with, well, just so much confusion when it comes to the traditional family, so much rebellion. We're going to go through Isaiah 1 once again and just see. Of course, you can look at the middle part of that book, the book of Isaiah, and see where it's very much for the last days, and we're seeing it. It's being fulfilled. We've gone through Isaiah 3 quite a lot on this program, so we'll focus more on that sickness that's prophesied there in the first chapter of Isaiah. Well, 40 years ago this month, the Shah of Iran's government collapsed, and that opened the way for the Ayatollah Khomeini to impose Islamic rule over the Iranian people. They call it now the Islamic Republic of Iran. And since that revolution of 1979, the image of Iran, if you're thinking clearly anyway, the image that Iran ever since that revolution of 79, it's been one of intolerance, fanaticism, and state sponsorship of terrorism. Today, it's the largest state sponsor of terror in the world, and they're proud of it. The Iranian clerics, the leaders, the religious fanatics, they are proud of that track record. 40 years of it. But what a dramatic turning point this month was back in 1979 for the Iranian people. A turning point that really and truly did embarrass the United States. And it propelled the religious heads in Iran. It propelled that nation to the radical Islamist state that we see today. And if you just look at some of the background in the lead up to it, it really is shameful the way Western elites responded to this revolution, or maybe a better word would be encouraged. They really encouraged it. For 30 years before the revolution, the Shah, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, or Pahlavi, I forget the exact pronunciation, but we'll call him the Shah, that's a lot easier. He had been leading Iran. He was a strong ally of America. He was leading the nation through a number of social and political reforms. He wanted to modernize Iran. He wanted to propel it forward to be a global power. Back in 1963, he launched this ambitious white revolution plan, and this was a far-reaching government program that, as I say, it wanted to modernize the nation. It wanted to improve infrastructure development. He wanted to expand women's rights. He wanted to focus on education to combat the widespread illiteracy among the young in particular. But he met a lot of resistance, even within his own nation. These ambitious goals that the Shah had, they didn't hold well for the traditional Islamist elites in Iran. They saw the reforms, the Shah's reforms, not as modernization or advancement. They saw it as westernization, and they hated that. And so the religious sphere, led by the Shiite cleric, Ruhollah Khomeini, they mounted a strong opposition against the Shah. They wanted him out. And that political unrest, it rapidly turned into full-scale revolution. Khomeini said, "I will strike with my fists at the mouths of this government. From now on, it is I who will name the government. I'm going to take over." Now, in order to win favor from Western elites, Khomeini, he was very careful about what he said publicly. He was very careful about what he said when the cameras were on. He too promised minority rights, equality for women. "Well, I'm going to advance this nation like never before." He said a lot of things that Western elites rather liked. And they thought maybe Khomeini, this religious fanatic, they thought maybe he would be a better alternative. After all, the Shah was a dictator too, and he wasn't really a man that came to power through democratic means, and there was some corruption in his government. So maybe Khomeini's the answer. Khomeini, as I said, he said all the right things, but he was duplicitous. He'd say one thing to the Western media, and then he'd say another thing to his own people or to Iranian students and educators. He said to them, this is back in March of 79, "Don't listen to those who speak of democracy. They are all against Islam. They want to take the nation away from its mission. We will break all the poison pens of those who speak of nationalism, democracy, and such things." Poison pens. Well, he came to power, as I say, 40 years ago this month. And as soon as he grabbed hold of power, he very quickly abandoned almost all of those very public pledges that he made. And along the way, during that transition, the Western elites were fooled. They fell for it, hook, line, and sinker. The New York Times had an op-ed piece in mid-February of 1979. 40 years ago, and the title of this piece, "Trusting Khomeini." We trust him. We're the New York Times. We're the paper of record. That op-ed was written by a Princeton University professor. And he said that the depiction of Khomeini as fanatical, reactionary, and the bearer of crude prejudices seems certainly and happily false. Well, we've got it all wrong. He's not an extremist. He's not fanatical. He's not a reactionary. This Princeton University professor, he said that Khomeini may yet provide us with a desperately needed model of humane government for a third world country. That's the New York Times in 1979. They got it wrong then, and they get a lot of things wrong today. And in some cases, we make the same mistakes over and over again. Here is the New York Times writing about this Muslim fanatic that was now in charge of Iran, saying that he may be the model of humane government. It's shameful enough that the media went along with this revolution, many of them. But what's worse is that the U.S. government, we abandoned the Shah's rule. American officials in Washington, under Jimmy Carter's administration, they started to view the Shah's rule as, well, it's not democratic enough. And so they withdrew some support. America's view on the situation at the time, well, it couldn't have been more damaging for the Shah. Without U.S. backing, he didn't stand a chance. And so he was forced to leave the nation for Egypt. It happened on January 16th, 1979. That's when he was forced to flee. And then the Ayatollah, he returned to Iran from exile. He returned on February the 1st, 1979. And then the revolution was over 10 days later, February 11th, 40 years ago today. And we have what was the beginning of the so-called Islamic Republic of Iran. And the fruits of that tragic mistake for America. We helped oust the Shah. And we should have learned from that mistake immediately. You look at what happened, even in 1979. But look at the bigger picture. Look at the last 40 years. The number one state sponsor of terrorism. We wanted the Ayatollah to come in. We thought maybe it would be more democratic. We thought maybe he'd be more humane. Listen to what my father wrote. This is from the King of the South booklet. He said, "When the Shah led Iran, he was a strong ally of America, but our liberal press and politicians thought he was too undemocratic, so they helped to drive him from power. He went on to say that America provided little or no support when his government began to topple. It says, then, this is my father writing, then in 1979, Ayatollah Khomeini overthrew the Shah. Khomeini established Iran as the world's number one state sponsor of terrorism. 10 years later, shortly after Khomeini died, Hashemi Rafsanjani became president and intensified Iran's international network of terrorism. It was only then that some observers began to see what a terrible mistake liberals had made in assisting the Shah's downfall. Only then they began to see, well, maybe we made a mistake. You would think they would have learned it even in the latter part of 1979 during the hostage crisis. We'll talk more about that here in just a second. But then my father gets into some of the quotes from the 1990s during the Clinton administration, when the Secretary of State at the time called the nation of Iran the number one state sponsor of terrorism. That was just a standard policy for U.S. officials. That was the U.S. assessment. Because again, we used to look at the track record. They're killing people. They're killing Americans. They're killing Israelis. They're sponsoring terrorism. My father said, more than any other nation apart from Iran itself, America is responsible for the overthrow of the Shah and the ushering in of Ayatollah Khomeini. Our weakness could prove to be the biggest foreign policy disaster of the 20th century. Now, we've made this point before about these central players in latter days prophecy. How that Iran, as we know now, is the king of the south. The king of the north is headed up by Germany. And in many cases, you see the United States helping these movements, helping these hostile actors, helping these traditional enemies to gain power, to grow in power and might. We've certainly seen that with Iran in these last 40 years. We've seen it all the more in the last two decades or so. Listen to this this clip from my father's Key of David program. This goes back to 2007, and he's just giving some of this important history that we seem to so easily forget. Here's clip two.
Now, if you remember a little bit about history, we did almost the same thing to the Shah of Iran. Remember that 1979 when he was overthrown by Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran? And we talked about how corrupt he was. A journalist talked about that. And he was a strong ally of the U.S. And of course, I'm sure there was enough corruption there to agitate people. But still, he was a strong ally of the United States. And so we worked to get him out of there. And look what we got in return. You know where all this state-sponsored terrorism began? It began then when the Ayatollah Khomeini came in there, and that's how it all began in the Middle East.
You see, we thought it would be so much better. We looked at the alternative and thought, yeah, we need change. We need this Muslim cleric to come in and take things over. And he did. That was in 2007, my father's program, that is. And he was referring to that 1979 revolution. Listen to what he said earlier on. This is from 2003 in his Key of David program on the King of the South, clip three.
But where did all this terrorism begin? I mean, there had to be a beginning of all to this. It wasn't that way years ago, even a few years ago. In 1979, the Shah of Iran fell from power, and many of our leaders, politicians, many people in the press thought that was a good thing. It even helped to bring him down, frankly. because they believed he was too undemocratic. But he was also one of the closest allies that America had in the Middle East. And then after he fell, who came on the scene? Well, the Ayatollah Khomeini came on the scene then, and that is where state-sponsored terrorism began. It began right then, and really began very shortly with a supreme example of how state-sponsored terrorism works.
It began right away with the hostage crisis. The Ayatollah, he was all for that. Those youth storming the U.S. Embassy in Tehran and taking hostage those Americans. I forget how many. I think it was 50 or 60. He was all for it. The United States thought it was bringing justice to the Iranian people by supporting their cause to oust the Shah. And in return, look at the history. The U.S. paid a steep price. It was in November of 1979. So the Ayatollah comes to power in February, 40 years ago this month. And just 9 months or so later, those Iranian students stormed the embassy, the U.S. embassy, and took those Americans hostage. And over the next year, more than a year, then President Jimmy Carter, he tried to solve this hostage crisis with diplomacy, for the most part. He did sign off on a rescue operation. That turned out to be disastrous. But the diplomacy was a disaster as well, Khomeini said, in response to Carter's overtures. He said that he was beating an empty drum. And he went on to say that Carter does not have the guts to engage in a military operation. He was taunting the U.S. This is just a few months after the New York Times printed an op-ed saying, trust Khomeini, just trust him. You can do it. Just trust this man, this religious fanatic. Well, where did that get the United States? As I say, the diplomatic strategy, the rescue attempt, just spectacular failures. And so here were these Americans, dozens of them, trapped in the U.S. Embassy for 444 days. Well over a year of their lives in captivity. And it didn't end until President Carter finally was kicked out of office himself. And then the Ayatollah knew that he was dealing with a different president. So he was a little more cooperative with Ronald Reagan than he was with Carter. This was the first act of terror. Right after the Shah's ousting. But unfortunately for the world, it would not be the last. A 40-year track record. This was the new Iran that America wanted. That the New York Times wanted. That U.S. diplomats wanted. They helped bring the Ayatollah to power. And so we can look at ourselves. When you consider the number one state sponsor of terrorism, as Americans, we have to look at ourselves. We have to look at our own nation. Cause and effect, just like my father brought out in that Key of David program. We've played this clip from Anwar Sadat. He was the leader in Egypt at the time, later assassinated in the early 1980s. But listen to what he said toward the end of 1979. The Ayatollah had come to power in February, and then he has this interview, Sadat does, just a few weeks after those Iranian students storm the embassy. And listen to what he says about Iran and about their leadership. Clip one.
The country now is in chaos. And he has taken, power since last February for about 11 months now. And Iran is one of the richest countries in the world. They have a revenue of more than $250 million a day. He can build a villa and a car for every citizen there. Instead, the country is in chaos. No one rules. There's no government. And then this hostage, disgraceful thing that has taken place, especially when there has been women among them, for the sole reason that he wants to prove himself as a revolutionist against the United States. What has the United States to do with the Shah? The Shah has left Iran, and he is now a sick man thousands of miles out of Iran. I can't understand him. He is a lunatic. He is not a Muslim. I can say it because I am a Muslim. Where will Iran be heading? No one knows. But we can know one fact, that it is chaos, anarchy, and destruction.
Chaos and destruction, the hallmark of the so-called Islamic State. And when he was referring to the lunatic there, that was a reference to the Ayatollah. And if you remember, it wasn't that long after that interview that Sadat was assassinated by the Muslim Brotherhood, an ally of the regime in Tehran, Eli Lake, at Bloomberg. He says after 40 years, Iran needs a democratic revolution. Well, they very nearly had one in 2009, but Barack Obama pulled the rug out from underneath that one. He fell for the same lies as the New York Times in 1979. Even 40 years on. Well, back in the early days of the Obama presidency, I guess it was more like 30, 35 years on. And Ben Rhodes is creating the narrative, lying to the American people, saying, you can trust Iran. You can trust the leadership. You can trust the Ayatollah. The same mistakes and just an outright refusal to look at the facts, to look at what's actually happening, to look at the history. Lake says in 1988, so this would have been almost 10 years on from the revolution, there were mass executions of as many as 40,000 enemies of the state. Can you imagine 40,000 executions just in 1988? It says between 1979 and 2009, so that's the first year of the Obama administration, the regime arrested, imprisoned, or killed at least 860 journalists. Journalists persecuted, murdered, incarcerated. That's just been the track record. You resist against the regime, and you may pay for it with your life. That's been the history. And this is the nation that U.S. officials, at least under the previous U.S. President, desperately, desperately wanted to make a deal with. Eli Lake says, no serious person believes Iran is a democracy, and yet it is still possible to hear in some quarters of Brussels and Washington pleasant nonsense about the contest of ideas between Iran's moderates and hardliners. Javed Zarif, Iran's foreign minister, he still sits for fawning interviews and pretends to be the envoy of a free country. Who can forget all of those meetings with Secretary of State John Kerry, the fawning interviews. Lake says too many Western leaders continue to trust Khomeini's successors. Even now, the European Union and former Secretary of State John Kerry are working to save the 2015 deal limiting Iran's nuclear program. They believe the Iranian regime's promise not to build a weapon when much of the agreement expires in less than 15 years. You see, they signed that deal back in 2016 and then told the American people and then told the U.S. Congress, you can trust the Iranian regime. You can trust the Ayatollah. The same thing we were saying in 1979. Trust Khomeini. Well, I think the other thing that's quite significant about this history, and my father's brought this out before, we've written about it a fair bit at thetrumpet.com, the story of the candelabra in the Armstrong Auditorium lobby, how that Mr. Armstrong, Herbert Armstrong, back in the 1970s, he purchased those candelabra from Harrods in England, and they were actually commissioned by the Shah of Iran back in 1971 as part of a celebration, a 2,500-year celebration of the Persian Empire and Cyrus the Great. The Plain Truth, Mr. Armstrong's magazine, The Plain Truth wrote, the purpose of the lavish seven-day festival, in the words of Iran's monarch, the Shah, was to reawaken the people of Iran to their past and to reawaken the world to Iran. Here's the Shah and this huge celebration in 1971, bringing the attention of the world to what was happening in Iran and helping the Iranian people to understand their history. The history of the great Persian Empire. My father wrote in this article, some historians believe that the Shah's costly and elaborate anniversary celebration, which overlooked the Islamic religion, in other words, the Islamic religion was snubbed. The Islamic religion wasn't really part of this celebration. He says that some historians believe that the Shah's costly and elaborate anniversary celebration was the spark that lit the fire that ended up seeing the country hijacked by radicals in 1979. He has this grand celebration at the start of the 70s, and by 1979, he was fleeing the country for Egypt, for safe haven in Anwar Sadat's Egypt. Not long after that, the Shah was very sick and died soon after. And then, as I mentioned, Sadat himself assassinated, what was it, the end of 1980 or in 1981? I forget the exact year or time, but we've talked about that history before on this program as well. But here was the Shah in 1971, the early 70s, commemorating the reign of King Cyrus. This great king in the Bible that God actually used. God stirred up the spirit of Cyrus to decide that the Jews could go and rebuild the temple, build the house of God. That's some pretty exciting history for the Jews and for the Persians. But notice this point that my father made. This is from 2006. It's in a Royal Vision article. He said the Iranians were celebrating Persia's greatest king who served God. That's speaking of Cyrus the Great. And my father says Satan was enraged and quickly led the overthrow of Iran's Shah. And he was replaced, it says, by a madman. So it's important to consider as well Satan's involvement here and what he was doing and thinking and what he was plotting even back in 1971 as the Shah was there bringing attention to Iran's own history that went back 2,500 years And Satan, filled with rage, he was plotting the overthrow of the Shah. That happened. That process was complete 40 years ago today, February the 11th, 1979. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, we went through quite a few emails on Friday's show. And if you'd like to have one of your messages read live on the air, you can send it to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States, one in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror, their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening, and what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe. And it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings? What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
I mentioned Isaiah the prophet, his book at the start of the program, and how it's for the end time. You can see that in Isaiah 30 in verse 8, where God told the prophet to go and write this vision down on a table or in a book, that it might be for a time to come forever and ever. So he wanted it in a book, God did. God wanted it written and recorded in a scroll because it's for us today. This is not just history. The book of Isaiah is not just ancient history. It's prophecy. And it's prophecy for the time to come, or the latter days. In Isaiah's end time vision, my father says, so what is the main reason for the book of Isaiah? Why was it put in the Bible? He says, because it was a message for the end time, for today, right now. He says further on, the book of Isaiah will have been written in vain if we fail to understand that it's for us today. It's for our time today. So when you back up then, that's Isaiah 30 in verse 8, and that quote's from Isaiah's end time vision. But you back up then to the beginning of the book, Isaiah 1 in verse 1, it says, the vision of Isaiah, the son of Amoz, which he saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. Hear, O heavens, verse 2 says, and give ear, O earth. Hear this message, the heavens and the earth. It's for all of mankind. It's even for the heavens above. The Eternal has spoken, he says, I have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me. Mr. Armstrong says in chapter 1 of Mystery of the Ages, he says, look, it's important here to understand that at the very outset of this chapter, God calls these humans his own children. We are the children of God. How come you don't hear this in traditional Christianity today? You hear nothing about the fact that we were born with the potential to be born as family members in the God family. God speaks of us as children. This is the idea that Mr. Armstrong wanted to get across right at the outset of Mystery of the Ages, right at the outset of chapter 1. Who and what is God? What's God doing here? Why would God call us children? And why should God be so unreal to most human beings today? How come we don't recognize him as the Father that he is? Well, verse 3 in Isaiah 1 says, "The ox knows his owner and the ass his master's crib, but Israel does not know. My people does not consider." You can look at a dumb ox or a donkey and see that there's more of an understanding there of where their owner is, of where their master is, than there is even with human beings. Now that's sad and shameful. We can't find our way back to the Father. We can't find our way to the Creator, the one who made us. We've rejected God as Creator. We've rejected him as ruler. We've rejected him as the provider, the protector, the forgiver, the educator that he is. God loves his children more than he loves himself. Did you know that? And he agonizes here at the start of Isaiah 1, saying that even an ox knows his owner, but my people, they don't consider this. They've abandoned me. They left me. They've fallen away from the truth. That's Isaiah 1 and verse 3. And then look at verse 7 again. When you think about these prophecies having been fulfilled, or they are being fulfilled, the prophet says, "Your country is desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. Your land, strangers devour it in your presence. And it is desolate as overthrown by strangers." That's a prophecy. And that's being fulfilled. The Washington Times had a piece today saying that illegal immigration on Mexico border, it's on pace to be the worst year since 2007. The worst year in 12 years. That's the pace that we're on right now. And here they're arguing over, what is it, $5.7 billion? And we'll talk about these astronomical debt figures here in just a second. But it says that the Washington Times, 4 months into the fiscal year, the Border Patrol nabbed nearly 200,000 people compared to about 109,000 at the same point in the previous year. It says, if that 84% surge holds, it works out to 733,000 immigrants crossing illegally for the fiscal year 2019, which would be by far the highest numbers in more than a decade. By far the highest numbers. And this article points out how that it's especially hard to curtail this because there's so many families coming, families with children. And we've typically been more lax with our enforcement of immigration laws when it comes to families with children. And of course, President Obama's executive actions made it easier for them to get in as well. So here is a nation just being devoured by strangers. That's what's happening, prophetically, I mean. This is not a race thing. This is just a Bible prophecy being fulfilled thing. God said it would happen, and it's happening. It's happening before our eyes, and it's not getting worse, or rather, it's not getting better. It's worsening. There's a story at the Hill, not a story, this is a report. The $1 trillion problem that Americans have. It says, while large numbers defy comprehension, Americans should try to wrap their minds around the huge sums of money owed on the fastest growing segment of the federal budget. Listen to this. The interest expense on the national debt will hit the $1 trillion mark in a decade, and then it's going to be over a trillion from every year thereafter. In one decade, that's 10 years. That's when your five-year-old is 15 years old, $1 trillion per year goes toward what in the federal budget? Interest payments. That makes $5.7 billion seem like what it is, just a tiny, tiny, tiny drop in the bucket. As we haggle over that and whether or not we can build a wall, look at what we're spending money on. Not just in times of war. Look at what we're spending money on. Look at how much money we're spending in times of peace. And that article brings this out as well. It says millions, billions, and trillions may be phonetically similar, but they have vastly different magnitudes. A million is certainly large, but a trillion is a million times a million. A million times a million. Every year, just in interest payments, just to pay off those that loan us money. It says here, Americans should not be surprised by the magnitude of this interest cost because the federal government has for many years followed a deliberate policy of spending more money than it collects, thereby requiring heavy borrowing in good times and bad. You can almost understand it when there's a national tragedy. Just in the recent history I've been reading last week about the World War I era and then coming out of that and what they were facing, President Wilson, and then after him, I guess it was, who was it, Harding, and then Coolidge, who finally started to cut back on spending during the 1920s. But they were in a real bind. They had accumulated a lot of debt during World War I, and then the same thing happened in World War II, as we know. It was even worse here in Britain. But what does it say about our leaders, about our politicians, that they spend like drunken sailors, even when there's times of peace and prosperity? It says, even now, with low unemployment and interest rates, high asset values, and an expanding economy, the United States finds itself in a $1 trillion budget deficit pattern with little political will to alter a design where spending growth steadily outpaces revenues. In other words, the economy, and the president keeps saying this, the economy's doing well. Unemployment's low. Interest rates are low. We're expanding. The economy's expanding. And still, there's a $1 trillion deficit. Now, that's a sickness. That is a sickness. And you consider what it says in Isaiah 1. Ah, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers, children that are corruptors. They have forsaken the eternal. They have provoked the Holy One of Israel unto anger. They've gone away backward. We're going the wrong direction. Richard sent me this article. The source isn't the greatest, but just judging by the links within the source, it's just quite a few mind-blowing facts about America. Facts that everyone should know. Approximately 1/4 of the entire global prison population is in the United States. 1/4 of the criminals incarcerated on earth, they're in the United States. Is there any correlation between that and the next point on the list? That by the time the average American youth reaches the age of 18, he or she will have witnessed something like 40,000 murders on television? 40,000? Just violence, just constant, a nonstop stream of violence coming into our minds through these powerful images on TV, on screens, in movies. And we spend a lot of time in front of the screens. That's another point on the list. 6 hours, 43 minutes of screen time every day. That's the average in the United States. And this list of mind-blowing facts, as it says, it talks about the breakdown of America's infrastructure. All these structures that are structurally deficient. And you've got people on the radical left, like I covered on Friday's program, that say, well, let's go rebuild every single one of them. These pie-in-the-sky programs that would cost tens of trillions of dollars more. But that said, there are a lot of structures, a lot of infrastructure, a lot of bridges in the United States that are structurally deficient. The average dam in the United States, or the age, rather, of the average dam, I shouldn't say average, the average age of the dams in the United States, 52 years. These are structures that have been around for decades, for half a century. And then you look at the American diet. There's some points on the list about that, just how unhealthy we are physically. The study recently that found that one-third of all American teenagers haven't read a single book in the past year. One-third of millennials still living with their parents. The suicide rate in the United States, it's risen 33% since 1999. These are problems. This is a sickness. It says women have earned at least 57% of all bachelor's degrees in the United States for 18 years in a row. We have more women graduating, quite a few more. More women who are educated than men. What does this mean? More than 100 churches in the United States are dying every single week. More than 27 million acres of U.S. farmland, it's owned by foreigners. According to Bloomberg, this list says, it's being projected that by 2025, shortfalls in infrastructure investment will subtract as much as $3.9 trillion from U.S. gross domestic product. That's infrastructure investment, so-called. And then all the other trillions, the deficit each year. It was in 1980, this article brings out, that we first passed the trillion-dollar plateau in the federal debt. Now we're at $22 trillion, more than $22 trillion, and there's no end in sight. It just keeps going up. What does it say in the book of Isaiah? What does it say? Ah, sinful nation. I read verse 4. Look at verse 5. Why should you be stricken anymore? You will revolt more and more. The whole head is sick and the whole heart is faint. It says in verse 6, from the sole of the foot, even unto the head, there is no soundness. There's no soundness in it, but wounds and bruises and putrefying sores that have not been closed, neither bound up, neither mollified with ointment. Look at how God compares our society to the sickness that exists in the human mind and body, like a cancer. That's in Isaiah 1, and as I read at the top of this segment, Isaiah 30 and verse 8, it says, this is for the last days, is for our time today. The Federalist had a piece recently that asked, where has all the culture gone? What's happening to us? It says, from the New York Island to the Redwood Forest, Western civilization continues to collapse, gradually now, but soon, maybe suddenly. For now, only a relatively small band of traditionalists are manning the gates against the cultural nihilists. It says later on in the article that 800,000 babies are aborted each year in the United States. That is some kind of sickness and disease. That's in the United States every single year. And, you know, a pretty big chunk of them are black babies. And nobody says anything about it, what's happening in the black community, and why this is so disproportionate, and what we can do to correct it. Nothing. It's just women's rights. Women's rights. A woman's right over her body. Never mind the family. Never mind marriage. Never mind these institutions that God created. What did he say at the start of Isaiah 1? I have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me. And Mr. Armstrong said at the beginning of chapter 1 in Mystery that I think it's important here for the reader to understand and to know that God addresses us as children. We are God's children, and we have forgotten God. We have forsaken our Father. I have nourished and brought you up, God says, and you've rebelled against me. What he wants is for us to return to him, as it says later on in chapter 1, to come and to reason together with the Eternal. Well, look into that chapter and others like it, but Isaiah is quite a book, and chapter 1 is spot on when you look at some of the things we're seeing in our society today. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, don't forget, td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.